the Spirit of Jazz podcast, where music dances with mystery, with your hosts, Bill Carter and Jeff Kellum.
Welcome to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is Bill Carter.
And I'm still Jeff Kellum. Welcome indeed.
We're glad that you're here, and we're glad that our listener base continues to grow. But we invite you, please tell people about this podcast, because it's a lot of fun for us, and we're finding it's a lot of fun for other people too.
And as people listen to it and have things to contribute, there are ways to respond to the Spirit of Jazz.
That's right. You can send a note to us at podcast@presbybop.com, PRESBYBOP.com.
It's not that we don't have a lot of things to talk about, because we still have a number of things on our agenda. But if you have questions or you have comments or you'd like to know more about Presby Bop or about the whole idea of spirituality and jazz going hand in hand, be in touch as we're in touch with you.
We'd love to hear from you. So, Jeff, I thought what we do is today's episode, let's talk about how we fell in love with this music, and particularly if there were any key musicians or moments where our interest was sparked.
Well, while I think about that, you start, because I have a question for you. When I meet with other jazz musicians, other than you, not me, because I'm not a musician, but as I meet with people, I talk about Presby Bop and I talk about Bill Carter, and I would say you were kind of a disciple of Dave Brubeck, and I know you play piano, obviously. How did Brubeck's music influence you, and what drew you to Dave Brubeck instead of other jazz pianists whom we could name on three or four hands?
Well, let's see. That could be a long story, so let me see if I can keep it focused. I began taking piano lessons when I was 8 years old or so, and I fumbled at it. And my younger sister was always better because she practiced. And I think my grandmother, my mom's mom, took pity on me, because one day when we were visiting, she runs out to the car as we're loading it up and says, "Here, take these with you. Give these a listen." And it's an old paper shopping bag from a grocery store. And we go down the road and I open the bag, and there are two LPs by Dave Brubeck. I had no idea who that was. I called her, because my mother made sure that I called to say thank you. And I said, I asked, and she said, "Oh, he's like the greatest jazz pianist ever." Okay.
That's a good recommendation.
Yeah. So I put the platters on the record player when I got home, and I was instantly enchanted. One side of the album was J.J. Johnson and Kai Winding playing at the Newport Jazz Festival, and the other side was the Dave Brubeck Quartet playing at the Newport Jazz Festival, where he introduced a tune called "In Your Own Sweet Way," which I later found he wrote in honor of his wife, and a piece called "Two-Part Contention," which was like a two-part invention. And I had just begun to explore those with my piano teacher. You know, Bach would have his right hand playing something and his left hand playing something, and they would bounce off one another and spin variations. And that's exactly what Brubeck did. And I couldn't believe it. And that was amazing.
Yeah.
And then the next album was all Dave's quartet with Paul Desmond, of course, on saxophone. And it was called "Dave Digs Disney."
Oh, yes.
It was all Walt Disney tunes. And they were redone, rethought, repurposed, reimagined. And the one that just nailed me, it slayed me, was "Someday My Prince Will Come."
Yeah, which is a jazz standard these days.
Well, it is, but all I could think of was the cartoon maiden scrubbing the stone steps, singing that someday her prince would come, and at the end, the prince shows up in the shadow, and he kind of sings it too, and I thought, this is a sappy song. Well, Jeff, they blew the lid off that thing.
Right, right.
And part of the experimentation was in the time signatures. It's a waltz. And then Brubeck starts playing in 4-4 over top of the waltz. And the drummer, Joe Morello, goes with him. And the whole thing is flawless. And certainly they had played it before that date. But it was incredible. I thought, this is the first time I've ever experienced somebody enjoying music while they're playing it.
Yes.
Because for me, piano lessons, they sparked a little interest, but it was often a drudgery. So fast forward a bit, in the fall of 1998, I had the opportunity to meet Mr. Brubeck. I get a phone call from the interim pastor at Nassau Presbyterian Church in Princeton, New Jersey. That call came actually in the spring. And he said, "We're bringing Dave Brubeck to our church. Would you like to come down and preach the sermon that Sunday?" I said, "Sure."
No kidding.
He said, "Don't you need to ask your elders on your board?" I said, "No, I'll be there. I'm just going to tell them this is a vacation date or whatever." And he said, "And what would you like as compensation?" I said, "Well, give me the guest preaching sum, whatever that is, and put me up for the night before. And could I have Mr. Brubeck's phone number?" He said, "Certainly." So he gave it to me, and it sat there on my desk for weeks.
Oh, imagine the moxie it would take to dial that number.
Yeah, what do you do? You call him up and say, "Hi, I'm a schmo from Pennsylvania. I like your music. I'd love to meet you someday." I'm sure he had rings of protection around him to keep that from happening. Well, summer went on, and the invitations kept coming from that church and through that church. So could I bring my jazz quartet down a couple weeks before his engagement, play a concert because they had not heard a lot of jazz? Could I come sometime in the summer and do an adult education forum on what to listen for in Mr. Brubeck's music? I got a phone call from him right after I taught that adult education class, and it was Dave. And he said, "I hear you like my music, and we're going to meet." I said, "Well, yeah, sir, I'd like to meet you before." He said, "Well, come on up for lunch." Wilton, Connecticut. And I said, "Well, I would love that." We picked a date. I gassed up the car, and I drove 3 hours over to Connecticut, found the house, knocked on the door, and nobody answered. And I knocked on the door, and nobody answered. And I knocked one more time, and another door 15 feet away opens, and he's standing there, the Grammy Award-winning Dave Brubeck, and he's in a white terry cloth bathrobe, eating a bowl of rice pudding. "Oh, you must be Bill. Is this the day?" He'd forgotten. He'd been up all night composing, and he invites me in and introduces me to his wife, Iola, who starts pulling food out of the refrigerator so we can eat together. And the upshot of the day was we're sitting in his music room. We start playing a duet on that tune, In Your Own Sweet Way.
Wow, man.
And it was crazy. I'm pitching myself, and we're talking about music, and we're having a grand old time. We immediately hit it off. What I did not realize is he had these circles of protection around him. He, had a manager.
Sure.
And he had a personal assistant named George who kind of guarded the door and all kinds of things that kept him from people who would take advantage of him.
Yeah.
Very personable man, but, he had learned at that level of notoriety, you have to be careful.
Yeah.
And that began a friendship. When I remarried, he sent a wedding gift. We traded Christmas cards for years. Often his cards included a scrap of a composition that he was working on. And for my 40th birthday, which of course now is a long time ago, he invited me down to Chattanooga to experience a piece he had written for the 1987 papal visit to San Francisco.
Yeah.
He affectionately called it the Pope Show. and we've talked earlier about that piece in an earlier episode. He said, "If you come down and, we'll pick up the cost of everything. You've got to get the plane ticket or the transportation." And I had breakfast with his drummer, Randy Jones. So I wander over to the sound check before the concert. Dave's not there.
Hmm.
And his manager, Russell Gloyd, is banging some piano chords. They're doing a sound check. And then Russell sees me and says, "Bill, sit down and play the tune." So I played with the Dave Brubeck Quartet.
I've told people that I know a guy who played piano with the Dave Brubeck Quartet, and it ain't Dave Brubeck.
It was crazy. It was crazy. It was just pure grace opening up. I enjoyed kind of hanging out with the guys and the musicians, Bobby Militello, the saxophonist who lives in Buffalo, New York. And I kept running into these guys over and over again in the years. His Christmas cantata, we went to Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York, and he waves to me from the floor of the setting. And it was remarkable. So it was a friendship, but it pulled me in ever more deeper to understand his music, and particularly that large body of material that had religious purpose to it, which right. many people don't know about.
Right.
And there's nothing like that to engage you in and excite you about a musician's music.
Yeah.
So that's my story. How about you? Who have been some of the key figures, or was there a moment that sparked you?
I've mentioned before that the first live jazz I ever heard was at the old IBM Country Club. The IBM was based in my hometown, and I had the opportunity to go to this $5 a year country club or whatever it was that Dad had joined. And the Ralph Lanigan Band played, and then the Jimmy Dorsey Orchestra played with the High Lows. And so the big band kind of became my favorite kind of music. And when I was in high school, I would walk down from the high school down to the Woolworths, and I'd go through the bin of records, and I found a series of albums that had been recorded by the Francis Bay Big Band from Brussels, Belgium, recorded at the Brussels World Fair, 1958. Now, this would have been, you know, like 4 years later. These were on the very famous Omega record label. Then I bought the first one. And then I bought the second one. And these were all original arrangements by Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller, Stan Kenton, Count Basie, Artie Shaw. Mm. And so, you know, I had my record player, and I still have these albums, and they still sound pretty good. Yeah. So that was my introduction to this music. And because these were budget records, that was my first collection of this, to me, an obscure band leader. Well, I went online when Google came around and found Francis Bay and discovered that he was indeed a real person. This was not one of these 101 strings kind of things where you find some orchestra somewhere and give them a label. Oh, and the other person was Tommy Dorsey, because as a kid, I played trombone. I remember winning a contest in junior high school. It was a music appreciation quiz, and I got everything right. And so I got $5. That was the teacher's reward for me. And so instead of buying classical music, I went and bought a Glenn Miller album, and I brought it in and showed it to Mr. Schmall, Harrison Schmall. He said, "I got no problem with that. That's no strings attached music. You buy what you want." So there was the trombone of Miller, and then the trombone of Dorsey. And the Dorsey band, of course, was different from the Miller band. And I've mentioned this, I think, on a previous episode. Yeah. So, and then, of course, if big bands, then I move into Duke Ellington. And I think the Ellington music, from the Ellington standards, then into the sacred music concerts, where I bought the first mm-hmm. album, and then bought the second album, which I think was a two-record set. David danced before the Lord with all his might, had the tap mm-hmm. dancing in the background, recorded at the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. This was my music. Now, my pianist, and I've told you this story, but the podcast listeners haven't heard it, that my very first radio interview in college, I'd not interviewed anyone before, but George Shearing came to campus. And so I knocked on the door of the practice rooms in the Westminster College Conservatory of Music at the invitation of the Shearing road manager. The door opened, and there's George Shearing in his boxer shorts with his garters, holding up his socks. His dresser, because Shearing was blind, his dresser was helping him get ready for the concert. And so he helped me, this fledgling radio announcer person, move through the interview. When my questions about music were like, "Where do you play next? Where are you going next?"
Right,
and just inane questions, but he was very gracious, wonderful sense of humor. So, of course, then I started getting Shearing's music. One other comment, too, before we move into still a third person, if we go back to Derek. The idea of Shearing, of course, he used strings many occasions, and so did the Dorsey Band with strings. And this idea of joining jazz with the orchestra, the more formal classical sound, I never really got into it very much, but it was a thing. And mm-hmm. so that was
right.
a little bit more that expanded my vision of what big band music and what an orchestra could sound like when it swings with strings.
Yeah, but that was probably well-funded when there were actual record companies. They would put a big budget piece out and such. And in fact, we are going to do a big band concert in my town later this year. We're going to try to use some of the classic Count Basie recordings and some Buddy Rich recordings. But our second half is going to be some pieces put together for Ella Fitzgerald.
Oh my.
And a lot of those had string arrangements, and we don't have a budget to have a small string orchestra too. So we have to figure out what we use and what we cut. But yeah, it was a big thing through the 40s and 50s, particularly into the 60s.
That reminds me, another one of my treasured albums was one I bought as a kid with Ella in Berlin. Was it Paul Smith?
Her pianist. Yeah.
It was live. She forgets the lyrics to Mack the Knife, so she kind of just vamps it. And boy, I played the life out of that and then found it later on CD. So I can play either version of that.
And one thing leads to another. You listen to some music and you find out who else is performing on the recording, and you chase the musician that you like. That's been very true of Miles Davis. First started listening to Miles Davis, and then wanted to find out more about Herbie Hancock and then about John Coltrane. Those conversations bring it back to mind. You know, I grew up in the town where you live currently, and they had a James Way department store. I went down one day. My mom had to pick up something and let us wander, and I found a bin of records, LPs, that had cuts in the side of the piece. In other words, these were the records that couldn't sell, so they're being discounted.
Yeah, they're called cutouts.
Cutouts. And I found a cutout LP of Ornette Coleman called Love Call. And it was probably $1.99, maybe, or something like that, in a James Way department store. And I took it home, and it blew the hair off my head.
Wow.
I mean, it was wild. He was playing with John Coltrane's rhythm section shortly after Coltrane had died. And he had Dewey Redman on tenor sax along with him. It is a wild album. I mean, I had never heard anything like this. And yet I was kind of drawn in because, you know, my peers were all listening to experimental rock. I had something that was even more revolutionary and could anger your parents even quicker. It's Ornette Coleman.
Right. Oh, my. Oh, yeah. Great stories. Now, what about, we mentioned Derek Bang earlier, an interview with him, but he's got something to contribute here too.
Well, he does. We had some material that we couldn't use for the two previous episodes with him. But he talks about how he fell in love with the music of Vince Guaraldi. So let's play that for our listeners, and then we'll come back and wrap this up. So tell us about how you came to write about Guaraldi, and maybe about the book that you've put together and now are revising.
I am. That's true. I am deep in the woods, as they say. My interest in Guaraldi dated back to the debut of A Charlie Brown Christmas on December 9th, 1965, although I didn't know that he was involved with the show at the time because the credits went by so quickly, I had no opportunity to find out. It took me a couple more years to figure out that he was, in fact, the guy. And my interest in his music was pretty constant from that point forward, although I didn't really get serious about digging into his back catalog until I was in college and had more time, opportunity, and local record store resources in Northern California to pursue that kind of a search. Got married, my wife and I, in the early 1990s, learned of a group called the Peanuts Collector Club. And my wife, Gan, and I are both avid Peanuts tchotchke collectors. Our house has been described as a museum.
I think that's fair.
And the club president in the mid-90s, when the notion of setting up websites was becoming a thing, asked me to put together the club's first website, which I was willing to do. Well, websites, particularly if they're affiliated with an organization of some kind, you need content, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, one of the things that I'd like to put in this website is a nice lengthy article about Vince Guaraldi. And I discovered that almost nothing had been written about him. The man had been dead for roughly 20 years at this point in time, 2 decades. And I mean, he'd get a paragraph or two in books that covered, say, the West Coast jazz scene or jazz in general, but never anything of any particular substance, which I thought was puzzling. Well, it turned out that my little article, when it went live, was not only one of the first articles about Guaraldi to appear on the web, for many years it remained the only article about Vince Guaraldi to appear on the web. And it came to the attention of George Winston, who also remains a huge Guaraldi fan, has done 2 albums covering Guaraldi's music and keeps threatening to release a third, but other projects keep getting in the way. And he very kindly shared all the information that he had on Guaraldi, which was some recordings, copies of recordings that Guaraldi's ex-wife Shirley had let him borrow, and also a nifty article in Keyboard Magazine from 1981, which was then and still is one of the best 8-page assessments of Guaraldi's life and career that's ever been published. So that was really helpful. George and I corresponded. My interest in Guaraldi grew. George gave a performance in Santa Rosa in 1998, an all Guaraldi music performance in tandem with the arrival of a first album that he released covering the music. And my wife and I attended and found ourselves sitting behind Vince's son, David, and David's wife and son, and also Vince's mother, Carmela. When it was over, George brought us backstage and mentioned to David Guaraldi that I shared this interest in his late father. And David said words to the effect of, "That's outstanding. We should get together. I can show you stuff." I had the honor that evening of walking Carmela out to her car. Unfortunately, I did not subsequently put what ultimately became my decision to write the biography together quickly enough to interview her. She had passed by the time I got around to doing this anyway. David was as good as his word. He and his wife and son came to visit us at our home and brought with them 2 boxes of stuff, which he left with us. Don't get me wrong, I was bowled over by his generosity and the access to what turned out to be a treasure trove of clippings that Carmela had kept in scrapbooks for many years. But I mean, David didn't know us all that well. How trusting. I made copies of everything as quickly as possible and then had the original shipped back to him. I didn't want them in the house. I didn't want to be responsible. Well, having all that stuff allowed me to enhance the web pages devoted to Guaraldi's career. So now we move into the beginning years of the 21st century. And, you know, I kept waiting for somebody else to write a book about him. And nobody did. And round about 2005, I realized that time was running out. I mean, a lot of the guys that Guaraldi had worked with were getting very old. And that if something didn't happen quickly, they were going to be gone forever. So I stepped up to the plate. It was one of those, well, if nobody else is going to do it, then by gum, I'm going to do it myself. Not reluctantly necessarily, but I didn't necessarily feel that I had the jazz chops to discuss the topic with sufficient intelligence. And then I quickly realized that that wasn't really what a biography was anyway. That's the sort of thing that a music scholar would put together. And so for the next several years, I embarked on what became an increasingly productive and informative and delightful campaign to track down and chat with and formally interview as many of Garaldi's former sidemen and associates and friends as I could locate. And I will say this, perhaps not appropriate for this particular podcast, but I quickly discovered that jazz musicians tell some of the filthiest stories in the world, almost none of which wound up in my book.
Yeah, and yet I will say some of them are probably true. they have a tendency to honesty.
And they're, yes, that's very good. They're very candid people. They're a very candid group of folks, and utterly delightful. And yes, the book was published, Vince Guaraldi at the Piano, in 2012 by McFarland, which approached me, my publisher approached me about a year ago initially. And my editor said, have you thought about doing a second edition of your Guaraldi biography? I had just done two other books that they published back in 2020, which took 5 years out of my life putting those two books together. And I wasn't really ready to jump into another big project. But so my answer at the time was, yes, I have thought about it, but no, not right at the moment. Well, the moment came about, the beginning of this year. I decided, yeah, I think I'm ready. I've rested now for about 18 months. I am in the midst of that process, which it's a wonderful opportunity because both the benefit and frustration of publishing something like Vince Guaraldi's biography back in 2012 is that the book's presence, suddenly I began to hear from people that I wish I'd had the opportunity to interview and talk to before the book was published, right? It drew attention to its subject, which is wonderful. And so I have had all kinds of wonderful new information and anecdotes and interviews that I've been able to publish in the book's companion blog, which I set up when it was published back in 2012. It gives me the opportunity not just to include that new old information, but of course, it's also true that a lot has happened to Guaraldi's career in the past decade. He is much more famous now than he ever could have imagined being back when he was still alive.
That's great. Well, we're talking with Derek Bang today, Vince Guaraldi's biographer. His book, Vince Guaraldi at the Piano, you'll find a link to how to get your own copy in our show notes. Derek, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Bill. As I'm sure you're aware, Vince is one of my favorite topics, and I could go on for hours and days. And I know that you're a kindred spirit, and that makes it all the more enjoyable.
Well, thank you so much. That's Derek Bang in conversation with me, Bill Carter, about how he kind of fell in love with the music of Vince Guaraldi. And he has so many stories to tell. It's exciting to hear how jazz sparks the interest of young people and people not so young anymore.
And you know, we've told our stories, and if you as a listener of the podcast want to tell your story, we'd love to hear how you fell in love with jazz, or a particular jazz musician who has had an impact on your listening and your enjoyment of this genre of music.
And all of these stories, I think, point to the mystery behind it all of creative power and imagination, and at the bottom of it all, joy.
Amen.
Well, thanks for listening, and tune in again next time.
We'll be here, and we hope you are too. Thanks for listening to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is a production of Presby Bop Music. To find out more about Presby Bop, our music, concerts, and recordings, please explore our website at www.presbybop.com. And send us a note telling us what you think about the Spirit of Jazz. We'd love to hear from you. Check in with us again next time. I'm Jeff Kellum.
And I'm Bill Carter. Thanks for tuning in.